My name is Bob Doyle, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
And I'm sober today only through the grace and power of God in the program, in the people, and in the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And before I start, I'd really like to thank the committee for the privilege of coming down here to this convention and sharing with you the gift that people in Alcoholics Anonymous freely gave to me. And it's very special for me to be here at this particular convention. I was here 3 years ago when it was over at the Radisson, and I came out here at a very critical time in my sobriety. I was in my 11th year of sobriety, and I was going through one of the toughest things I've ever gone through in my whole life, drunk or sober. This one? Hello? Better? This one? Like that? Can you hear me? Some of you may be better off if you can't. Sure you want it up? Okay. Like I said, I was out here 3 years ago, and I had met John and Mary Emma, are close friends of mine, and I met Harold, who some of you know, and when I was in crisis, I came out here because after him, he was in Vegas, and he told us all how he had single-handedly sobered up most of Atlanta, and I figured anyone who could do that could surely help me at my time of need. And I came out here, and through the grace of God and the speakers that were here and the people I got to talk to, it was a very important point in my life. And I always remember that weekend. And I'm real glad to be here. And I'd like to, I could also tell you, I used to be ashamed to say this, I'm also a member of Al-Anon. I know there are Al-Anons. I can feel you. Can I see your show of hands, how many Al-Anons there are? Okay. I knew there was some here. I could feel you. I ended up about a year and a half sober joining Al-Anon as a result of service and 12-step work in Alcoholics Anonymous. I ended up a whimpering newcomer in Al-Anon. In Vegas, they call them double winners, but I like to think of myself as a double loser. I was a failure at controlling my drinking and a failure at controlling yours, too. And I discovered why so many alcoholics end up marrying Al-Anons. They finally found someone who thinks about them as much as they do. I saw the people stand up that were at their first convention or that were new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm real glad you're here. As a matter of fact, if you're sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous in your first couple months or couple weeks of sobriety, and you're anything like I was, I'm probably more glad you're here than you are. But I got to tell you, square business, that if you can come here and connect with a little bit of what some of us have found here, you've walked into the best deal you've ever walked into in your whole life. In your whole life. You know, I learned some things about alcoholism here that are very important to me. And one of the first things I learned is that this is a disease, and that this disease can only be treated in a state of absolute abstinence. So the name of the game for people like me becomes, you don't drink no matter what. You don't drink if your old lady sleeps with the trash man. You don't drink if you sleep with the trash man. You don't drink, and in a state of absolute abstinence, a guy like me can find a way to go in rooms like this. And there's a lot of hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can feel it if you're open to it and if you're desperate enough when you first get here. Another thing I learned about alcoholism is that it's a progressive disease. And I learned that by going in and out for a number of years. And it's the kind of disease that it gets so bad you think to yourself, it can't get any worse. And you know what happens? It gets worse. Right? And it gets so bad, it's almost like you think to yourself I used to think to myself at some point, if I could just get on my feet and feel better, I think I'd kill myself. Right? And you know, when it comes to alcoholism, a lot of things don't make any sense. Alcoholism is the only disease that I know of that uses the person who has the disease's own mind against them. So a lot of us die on real good intentions. A lot of us die on our best thinking. And a lot of us die because we never stop listening to this. And the mind, my mind is a wonderful tool. It can remember names sometimes. It can do addition and subtraction. It's a great tool, but it's a terrible master. And I thought for most of my life that I was my thinking. And you guys told me and taught me that I'm not my thinking. I'm the poor guy who has to listen to it. And that I don't have to run my life from here anymore. I learned in alcoholism, when it comes to getting sober, there's a lot of things in life that make perfect sense that we grew up believing and that in normal everyday living are right. But when it comes to alcoholism, don't make any sense. They're backwards. It's almost like when you're trying to get sober, it's baffling. It's like you've walked through the looking glass into Wonderland. Everything that used to make sense doesn't make any sense anymore. There's a lot of things when it comes to alcoholism that are considered assets in the regular world and normal living that when alcohol comes to alcoholism are liabilities. And there's a lot of things in normal life that are liabilities that when it comes to alcoholism are assets. In everyday living, if you come from a family that would never desert you, that would always be there for you, that would always bail you out, that would be considered an asset. When it comes to alcoholism, that's a liability. In normal everyday living, if you had a business or a job that you never had to worry about losing and you always had money coming in, that'd be considered an asset. When it comes to alcoholism, that's a liability. In normal everyday living, if you're bright and intellectual and a quick study, that'd be considered an asset. Believe me. That's a liability. You can smell our original thinkers here. So if you're sitting here and you're new and a lot of this doesn't make any sense, take a moment and look back over the last couple years at some of the things that have made sense to you and where they've taken you. And you may come to the conclusion that I came to, that if Alcoholics Anonymous were to ever possibly help me, it could never possibly make sense to me. Because everything that had ever made sense to me all but killed me. And if there's anyone here that's been a slipper or that's been in and out of AA, I really want to welcome you. And I always feel the most close to people who don't make this thing the first time. Because I didn't make it the first time. I ended up in my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in 1971. I was just a kid. And I didn't want to be there. I was there as a result of an institution I was placed in. And I was in a lot of trouble in my life. And I didn't listen to anything that I heard. The people there were old. I mean, the youngest member was, half dead. He was 35. I mean, I could see why he'd quit drinking. Jesus Christ, his life was over. I was a young kid, I'm just getting it. I had the illusion that my life's going to get better. And it got worse. And from 1971 to 1978, I was in and out of these rooms. I lived the progression of this disease, and I went places that no human being should ever go. And I did things to make myself hate me that people should never do. And I kept ending up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every institution I was ever placed into or went into, or every Salvation Army or county jail or detox center, always had AA there. It's like you guys were following me. And it was always the same thing. You know, Now, there were times in those years that I was in and out that I really tried to stay sober. You know, it gets, when you're out there on the streets and you've one more time just destroyed your life and rendered it down to zero, and you crawl out of the gutter and you get physically better in a detox, and you can still remember what you just went through, you can have an enthusiasm for trying to change your life. And there was a lot of times when I had an enthusiasm for staying sober. And there was a lot of times when I really didn't want to go back to that anymore. And my dilemma is that I would end up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would usually go in there and sit in the back of the room in the inventory section. And if you're like I am, you got to have an inventory section, because secretly I didn't feel like as good as the people there. And when I feel insecure and awkward around people, what I always do is I judge them. And it's the dumbwaiter effect. I'm hoping against hope that if I can find ways in my mind to put you down enough, maybe I'll come up and be even. Right? That if I can find enough wrong with you, maybe I'll be okay. The problem with that is, and I know some of you have tried that method, it doesn't work. It doesn't make me feel any better. It just makes me feel more distant. And so I'd sit in the back of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I wouldn't listen too much because I was real busy judging. But what I would observe is I would observe people who say they have a drinking problem, who stop drinking and who are very, very happy. Who stop drinking and their life has become wonderful. Now, you got to understand that what I remember, the ears that I was listening with then may be a little warped, but what it seemed to me at the time is that I would see people get up to the podium in Alcoholics Anonymous and take a six-month chip, and they would say that 6 months ago I was living in the dumpster behind the Alano Club, and through the grace of God and these wonderful 12 steps, I'm now the president of United States Steel or something like that, right? Now, I'm sitting in the back of the room. I got hair down to about here. I got a beard. The only reason I've bathed is because they've made me in the place I'm staying. I got clothes on that they've given me in there. When I was in Pittsburgh, I used to have this outfit that they gave me. I had check pants and check shirt, and the checks don't match, right? That's a fashion statement in Los Angeles today. And I would sit in the back of the room and I would observe you people, and what I observed is I observed you weren't drinking and you were happy about it. And see, don't get me wrong, I understood that I had a problem with alcohol. I've understood that since I was a kid. I was an instant alcoholic. When I was 12 years old, I was in and out of juvenile court as a result of alcohol-related offenses. And I knew that I had a drinking problem, but I didn't have the same kind of problem that you people have. And if there was another name for alcoholism, it would be, I'm the not quite like you disease. Right? Because I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I observed you guys and I compared how you look to how I felt, and it was really a big difference. See, I'm not drinking and I feel like a fish out of water. I'm not drinking and I have an emptiness inside me that I can't really talk about because I don't know how to talk about it. I don't know what to say. But sobriety to me feels like I'm doing time. And if you've ever sat in a county jail, you know what it feels like to do time. And here I am, you guys are I'm getting the message from Alcoholics Anonymous that alcohol is my problem. I've stopped drinking, and there's something really wrong with me. And I don't know what it is. And if I could have understood it enough to explain it to somebody, I would have. But it's just kind of a lingering emptiness. And I'm so withdrawn inside myself. And that's what happened. You know, in the big book, it says that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. And a self-absorbed person always feels so distant and disconnected from life because I'm inwardly focused. And I sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't feel like I fit there. I don't feel like you guys look. I know I have a drinking problem, and I know if to pick up a drink is going to destroy my life, and I'm going to end up back in the streets or back doing time, or you know, the things that happen to guys like me. But there's something else wrong with me, and I eventually, time and time and time again, I get to a point where I just get it up to here with being sober. And I get it up to here with being sober, and it doesn't matter what's at stake. It doesn't matter if I'm facing going to jail for taking a drink, or I'm going to be thrown out of some halfway house into the snow, or if I'm going to lose a job, or it doesn't matter. I get to a point where I have no mental defense against my own emptiness. And I can stand a lot of things. I can stand a lot of emotional pain, and I can stand a lot of things, but I can't stand extreme loneliness and emptiness for long periods of time. And eventually I pick up a drink, and I used to say, think it through, and I'd think it through and pick it up anyway, because I couldn't stand it. I love W.C. Fields. He said one time, I was sober one time, it was the most boring 45 minutes of my life. See, I understand that. See, it's like to me, I was a young guy, and to me, Alcoholics Anonymous was like, AA has good news and bad news. The good news is that maybe if I go to a lot of these stupid meetings, I'll stay sober the rest of my life, and the bad news is I'm going to live a long time. Right. So I had a dilemma, and I don't know, I'm different from you people. And then I would hear in the years that I was in and out, I'd hear people in AA talk about God. And I had a tough time with God. Every time somebody in AA, no matter what he was saying that I liked, if he'd mentioned God, I wouldn't listen to another word he said. It was like a steel door would close in my head. And I had a big time problem that I was raised a Catholic, which is kind of a separate recovery story. And now don't get me wrong. You gotta understand that probably the receiver was a little warped. What I heard in Catholic school as a kid about God and what was actually said may not be the same thing. But what I heard about in school about God and what I grew up learning and thinking was that there was this God who existed to judge me. And he had all these things I was supposed to do on these holidays and these rituals, and if I didn't do them or get them right, I'm in a lot of trouble. I'm going to go to hell. And hell's this place where they burn you and torture you, and it's awful, and it lasts forever. Never ends. And then they had this list of things that you're not supposed to do. And even if you're good enough not to do them, if you just think about doing them, you're screwed anyway, right? And I was the kind of kid that if you told me not to think about something, that's all I think about. The nuns used to have a saying, they used to say, you got to be pure of thought, word, and deed. And the minute they said the word pure, X-rated movies start going through my mind, right? And I'm a little kid, and I'm trying to be good, and I'm asking God, don't let me think that stuff, and I think it. And I tried to talk to one of the nuns one day, and she told me about a place for guys like me that if I was really lucky and was sorry for everything I thought and did, there was a place that God created that I could go that shows God's mercy, and there's hope there. It's a place called purgatory. You've been there. And in purgatory, that they burn you and torture you, and it's awful, but it only lasts for a couple hundred million years. And I got to be, now I don't want to offend anyone, but I got to be about 12 years old, 13 years old, and I discovered masturbation, and I could picture this meter in heaven kicking off thousands and thousands of years, and I haven't even done anything yet, I'm just practicing. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys talked about God, I had a big problem. And I didn't mix well with people. I couldn't talk to you guys like you talked to each other. But outside of having a God problem and a not fitting problem and a something else is wrong with me problem, everything else was kind of okay. I remember one time I was, right prior to going on my last drunk, I was staying at a place in the north side of Pittsburgh. It was a Skid Row recovery house. I can't even really call it a recovery house. It was more like a mission. And I was there because of every other place I'd been to, and they knew about me. But this place would take you over and over and over again. You know, it was for last gaspers. It was called the Ark House, and I was in a Skid Row section of Pittsburgh, and I went in there and I was living there, and it was run by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy's name was Chuck, and Chuck was always on my case about getting a sponsor. And I knew that he just wanted to trick me into asking him so he could put another notch on his big book, right? And I'd die before I'd ask him. And one night, they put us in the van, and they take us. They used to make us go to one outside Alcoholics Anonymous meeting a week, which I thought was very extreme. And they put us in this van, and they'd parade us. We're all Skid Row winos, and they parade us to this meeting. It was this big meeting. There was about 200 people there, and everybody at this meeting dressed up. And it was a lot of guys with their wives and girlfriends, and they just looked great. You know, the guys in three-piece suits and women in dresses and the jewelry. And we prayed into the back of the inventory section of the room. And, you know, we got long hair, all of us, and we're street people, you know. And I look around the meeting, and there's nobody there that I would have drank with. There's some people there that I would have liked to known where they lived and when they're not going to be home. And I'm in there one night, and this guy Chuck's on my case about getting a sponsor. And there's a guy, and he's given a pitch, and it's his 10th AA birthday. And I had never seen anyone who was one of you that was in quote-unquote Alcoholics Anonymous that looked like this guy. Now, there was a lot of people that were in the institutions I was in that looked like this guy, but this guy, he had long hair and a long beard. He's kind of scruffy looking. And only because of that I listened to him. And I heard him say some things that I suppose were said in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings where I was physically there, but I didn't hear him. And I heard him talk about the obsession to drink. And I heard him talk about going drinking until he passed out and going to the bathroom on himself. And, you know, that used to happen to me a lot, and it was so humiliating. I never wanted anybody to know about it. It's not cute in a 23 or 24-year-old man to do that. And I heard him talk about that paranoid feeling that used to eat at him, and where he'd be on his way to get a bottle of wine, and the feeling like everybody was looking at him. And I used to feel that all the time. Like,
I used to feel so dirty that when regular people, when I'd be on my way to on the streets or trying to panhandle money to get a bottle of wine, people would look at me and it would just like hurt me because I felt so dirty inside. And I heard him talk about that. And I heard him say a lot of things that really hit me, that were very true to me. And I didn't know how he knew about them unless he had been there. Because these are the things, the feelings behind this stuff is not stuff you read in a book, and you can't, this is not something some do-gooder counselor can tell you. You've either had to have been there or you weren't. And I knew this guy had been there. And after the meeting, I was sitting in the back, and I walked up across the room, and I thought to myself, I'm going to ask him to be my sponsor. And I thought to myself, if I ever had to talk to someone, maybe I could talk to him. And he's up in the front of the room with a bunch of guys, and they're laughing and carrying on. And I get, as I'm walking across the room, I start to choke up. And by the time I get up to him, I'm almost paralyzed. And I didn't understand what was going on. I understand now. See, what was going on with me is that I secretly believed that anyone else must surely feel about me the way that I did. And I couldn't stand me. So I subconsciously felt that if I were to ask him to be my sponsor, he would have to reject me and feel about me the way I did because I rejected me. And so by the time I got up to him, instead of asking him to be my sponsor, I said, "My name's Bob. How'd you stay sober 10 years? And he looked me right in the eye and he said, "I didn't drink." Now, up until that moment, I kind of liked that guy. But when he said that, he touched a big nerve with me. And the nerve was my secret. And my secret was that I don't have what it takes to not drink. You guys do. I can see it in you. You're happy about being sober. But I don't have it. And if you're new, if you hear nothing else that I say, please hear this. That it never occurred to me that you people didn't have what it takes to not drink either. It never occurred to me that what Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who don't have what it takes to not drink. And see, what I was doing is I was judging my raw, untreated alcoholism against the outward manifestation of the program of recovery in your life, and I was coming up a loser. I could come up nothing but a loser. I could come up nothing but different. See, I'm a real alcoholic, and as a real alcoholic, I am incapable of staying dry with untreated alcoholism for sustained periods of time. I can't stand it. I get to a point where I just can't take it anymore. And the most baffling thing about that is it's usually when things are going outwardly better than they've ever gone in my life. I can't tell you how many times I'd crawl out of an abandoned building or get out of a county jail and get into some halfway house, and I'd get a job and I'd get some nice clothes and I'd get a $100 car. And I'd get a girlfriend. I'd get some money in my pocket. Things are better than they've been out here. But in here, the untreated alcoholism is eating me up alive. And I don't understand what it is, and I can't tell anybody. I don't know what to tell them. I feel guilty for even being like that. And I go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and I feel guilty there because you're not like that. You guys have, I missed it, whatever it is. I'm physically sober. What's wrong with me? And what was wrong with me was a disease called alcoholism. And my alcoholism starts where the bottle ends. And all I ever experienced prior to Alcoholics Anonymous and getting immersed in this program was one of the symptoms of alcoholism. And let me tell you, I've seen alcoholism kill people that never picked up a drink. And anybody who's been around AA for any number of years have seen people they've come to know blow their brains out sober. and it's not from a personality or disorder. It's not because their mother sat them on the pot backwards as a kid. It's not because they didn't deal with their issues or any of that other stuff. It's because of a disease called alcoholism. It's a disease of separation, a disease of conflict, and a disease of terrible, terrible isolation. What really brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous finally, and I've come to believe brings a lot of us here, is that there's a place, and it's right outside the doors of AA. And it talks about it in chapter 11 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And at this place, you can go one way into the gates of insanity or death, or you can go the other way into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's called the jumping off place. And the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that we get to a point where we can't imagine living with alcohol, and we can't imagine living without it. We are at the jumping off place. We wish for the end. And it says that we know a loneliness such as few do. And the first time I ever heard that, I thought about the loneliness I felt because I drank away my friends and family and was all alone on the streets. And I don't think that's what the book means. I think the loneliness that the book's talking about is the loneliness that a guy like me feels when I'm sitting in a park with a bunch of guys passing a bottle of wine, or I'm sitting in a bar having double shots, and I'm drinking myself into oblivion, and I'm doing the only thing that I have ever found that allowed me to feel like I fit, that allowed me to feel connected to life and to other people, that gave me a sense of ease and comfort and like I belonged in this world, and I'm doing the only thing that had ever done that, and it doesn't work anymore. See, in my earlier days of drinking, I believe that alcohol was an effective treatment for my dis-ease of alcoholism. And I can remember dozens of times, you know, being on a job in some factory that I couldn't stand, and going to work hungover and hating the people there and hating the job and hating everything about it, and just I can't stand them. And, you know, everybody I worked with would walk around on eggshells around me, and I would just make it through that day because I could run across the street, order a couple double shots of Jack Daniels and a couple beers, and chill out. And I can remember many days I'd go over there, and after about the second double shot of whiskey, the people I worked with would start filing into the bar. And after maybe the third double shot, I'd start looking at them and realizing they're pretty nice people. Next thing I know, I'm shooting pool with them. I'm talking to some of the girls down at the end of the bar. And I feel a feeling of connectedness. I feel a part of, I feel like they look. But at the end of my drinking, if I had enough money to drink in a Skid Row bar, I'd sit at the end of the bar and drink myself in oblivion, and I'd look down at the bar and I'd watch the people that are laughing, and I'd watch the people that were shooting pool and talking to girls. And I know it, and I can't seem to come out and play anymore. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And that's a lonely, lonely feeling. When I'm doing the only thing in my life that ever gave me the feeling of connectedness that I fit, and I'm doing it and I still don't fit. And what brought me to the jumping off place and finally into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous was that alcohol stopped being an effective treatment for the dis-ease of alcoholism. And that's a horrible, horrible spot. If I hadn't had prior exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous, I think I would have surely killed myself. And been glad to do it. And been glad to do it. Just to get it over with. In 1978, I ended up in a treatment center for alcoholism in Las Vegas, Nevada. And something had just broken inside of me. On my last drunk, I finally realized the party was over. And I didn't want to know that the party was over. It's a terrible thing. The only thing that you ever had to hang on to, and you don't have it anymore. It's terrible. And that was my beginning of my journey with you. When I was about a year sober, I read a story in a book. It has nothing to do with AA or alcoholism, but this story taught me a lot about my bottom and a lot about this disease. And the story was about scientists that were doing experiments with laboratory rats. And what they discovered, that in the brain of the rat, just like in the brain of a person or a chimpanzee or most animals, there's a little part called a pleasure center. And they found that if they took two tiny wire filaments and put them into that part of the brain and passed a mild, undetectable electric charge through that part of the brain, that the rat would get loaded. And what they discovered is if they hooked the juice up to a pedal in the cage, that the rat would go over there and lay on that pedal. And he would lay on that pedal without eating, without sleeping. You could parade lady rats in front of him, and he'd say, "Leave me alone, I'm partying." And he'd continue to lay on that pedal, and he'd lay on that pedal until he passed out. He'd come to, continue to lay on that pedal until he died. And what really got to me is that they also discovered that after the rat had been laying on that pedal, that if they cut the juice, the rat would continue to lay on that pedal and nothing would happen. He'd lay on that pedal and nothing would happen. He'd lay on that pedal, nothing would happen, until it finally sunk into his little rat brain that the party was over. And instead of going back to being a rat, he would curl up into a ball and lay there and die. Because there was nothing to live for. And when I read that story, something grabbed me inside, because that is exactly how I felt. I understood. When I read about that poor little rat, something welled up inside of me. I understood that rat's dilemma because I lived it. And that's what it felt like when I finally got to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978. I was really more inside me, more dead than alive. I didn't come here with the spirit of enthusiasm. I come here broken. Only this time, people in Alcoholics Anonymous grabbed a hold of me, and in my brokenness, I was very teachable and very flexible. And they told me to start doing certain things. And I just started to do them. I didn't think about them. I didn't judge them. I didn't try to figure out if they were good for me. I just started to do them. And there were other attempts at sobriety, where I would approach sobriety with the attitude, okay, I can't drink anymore. I'll do anything to stay sober that seems reasonable to me. Now, the problem with that is, I'm trying to use the instrument that got me in that situation to counsel me, right? I'd been better off getting Charles Manson as a spiritual advisor. And this time, in my brokenness, I just said, okay, whatever. And they told me to start doing some certain things, and I was so fortunate. I fell into the hands of a group of people, and they're my home group today, the Floating Big Book group. There's a couple of guys came down with me from the group. The group sent them to, they're supposed to stand up if I lie. And I fell into the hands of this group, and they came into the hospital I was in, and they were real active in Alcoholics Anonymous and service and hospitals and institutions, and they still are today. And they believed in the principles in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't believe in therapy or reparenting or none of that other stuff. They believed in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and service. And I am so grateful I fell into their hands. I was so vulnerable and so broken that if I would have fallen into the hands of some Hare Krishnas, I might have ended up at the airport with a starter rope coming out of the back of my head selling flowers today. But I fell into these hands, and they told me to start doing certain things in my life. And they encouraged me to form four habits. And these four habits saved my life. And the first habit was the meeting habit. And the way it was put to me is that there's a meeting going on in this town anywhere, and you don't absolutely have to be somewhere else, you're to be there. And it doesn't count as a meeting if it's in the hospital you just came out of. And you have to get there at least 10 or 15 minutes early and talk to someone and stay 10 or 15 minutes late. The next habit was the God habit. They said, even though you don't believe in God, you're to hit your knees every morning and ask whoever's running this universe for the help to stay sober. And they said, every night before you go to bed, you hit your knees and you thank whoever's running this universe for that day of sobriety and know that you didn't do it. And the third habit was the transparency habit. They said, every day I must talk to another member of Alcoholics Anonymous about what's going on inside of me with my feelings and my thoughts and what's going on outside of me. Jobs, relationships, finances. And the last habit, and I've come to believe it's the most important, it's one of our legacies, is the service habit. That every day I say yes to some sort of service. Whether it's spending a half hour with some newcomer that needs to talk, or doing a fifth step, listening to a fifth step, or giving a guy a ride to a meeting, or going to a hospital and institution meeting, or being a secretary of a meeting, or a GSR, or an intergroup, or maybe at my business, being nice to someone instead of reacting to them that's having a bad day, and knowing that maybe I'm the only one that day that's treated them with any kind of dignity, even though they're really uptight and angry. But that I'm to do some kind of service every single day. And that's a powerful, powerful thing. Dr. Bob said that our whole fellowship boils down to love and service. And I am here sober coming up on 14 years, and I believe I would not be here or have survived my sobriety if it wouldn't be for a lot of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of 12-step work. I belong to a group that goes to a lot of hospital and institution meetings. I wouldn't be surprised that if our group as a whole does more H&I work in our community than intergroup as a whole does. We do a lot of meetings in hospitals and institutions. And I'm very, very proud to be a member of a group like that. There's a lot of people in that group that are my heroes. People that I watch that give them themselves freely to Alcoholics Anonymous, regardless of what the personal problems are at the time. There's a guy that I sponsor that's a member of that group who is dying of a terminal disease. And it will kill him. There's no cure for it. And he goes to a lot of hospital and institution meetings. And he devotes a lot of his life to trying to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to people who are newcomers. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing to watch. People like that are my heroes. And in this group, I got a sponsor, and I started getting into the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started going to a lot of meetings and doing a lot of, became a secretary, and then, you know, through the deal of intergroup and GSR and the whole thing, I started getting into the steps. And I guess it got to be time that my sponsor felt that I needed to start on a third step, because he went through a period where every time I would talk to him, he would tell me to read page 60 through 63 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was a quirk he had or something. And I'd start reading it, and it's, some of you I'm sure have read it, it's the part that talks about the actor who wants to run the whole show and forever trying to arrange the lights and the ballet and the rest of the players in his own way. It says in there, he's a victim of the illusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well. And I would read that, and I'd go to meetings, and I'd look around, and you know, I could really see how there were people in AA that were doing that. And you know, when God's given you that divine awareness, you just have that sense of urgency to tell him, right? And there's a line in the 12x12. It says that we will see our own defects of character in others before we will ever see them in ourselves. And I was reading that part, reading that book, that part of the book, and I was seeing how it was you. And well, I could see there was some really self-centered people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And one day, I was in a lot of pain. And it's been so long ago, I can't even remember what it was. But it was one of those kind of days that guys like me have when nothing's going your way and everybody's getting in your way and you're just frustrated and you just feel like you want to scream and yell at somebody. And I call my sponsor up because I'm going crazy, and he says, read page 60 through 60. So I pick up the book and I start reading it, and there I am. There I am. And it was one of the greatest connections I've ever made in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a great, great turning point for me. When I could see myself in those pages, I started to understand something that is a principle that I base my life on. And it's the principle that I am, was, and always will be the only problem I will ever have. Even though at times it looks like it's you, at times I become convinced it's you, it never was and never will be you. And when I started to see myself in that part of the book, it was a great turnaround. And I got with my sponsor and I got down on my knees and I said that third step prayer. And when I said it, I don't know that I really knew what I was doing. I don't know that I understood what I was saying in that prayer. And it's a very simple prayer. It says, God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as Thou will. And what I'm basically saying is I'm making a decision that my life, my growth, my well-being is no longer my business. And the next line is the most powerful line to me in that prayer. It says, relieve me of the bondage of self. And once I could understand that I was the problem, the most horrifying thing of that is that I don't know how not to be me. And yes, I put myself in conflict with everything and everybody. And yes, I'm the guy who wants to run the show, and I make myself miserable when things don't go my way. But how do I not be that way? Because wherever you go, there you are. And when I got to that line, relieve me of the bondage of self, it was the great hope that maybe God could do something here. Because it would take a miracle for a self-centered guy who was so inwardly focused and self-absorbed as I was, who was so full of fear that he was constantly afraid of everything and everybody, was going to get out of his grip. For me to be different than that would surely take a miracle. And I didn't even really understand what depth I was like that. And the next line of the prayer says, and take away my difficulties so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help of Thy love, Thy power, and Thy way of life. It doesn't say, take away my difficulties so I can make $500,000 a year, or so I can find her, or so I can be happy. It says, take away my difficulties so that victory over them would bear witness to those I might help. And that's a very important line, because I believe in the principle that I've been saved from an alcoholic death for one thing and one thing only. And that's to help God's kids. And just to the extent that I do that, God takes care of me. Now I want to talk a little bit about cleaning the house, and I don't want to run over. I believe in the fourth step, the way it's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I am constantly amazed at how many people who are sober a long time who have never done a fourth step the way it's outlined in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's There's a million four-step guides. Matter of fact, every untreated Al-Anon alcoholism counselor writes one. Some of them are the most bizarre things I've ever seen. Have you ever slept with a pony? Did you buy it flowers in the morning? You know, just... And I did it in my early sobriety. Instead of asking for help, I did one on my own like that. And the problem with that is nothing changed. Of course I put down a lot of secrets, and I was as honest as I could be, and I put down all the things that I had hidden away inside of me that I was ashamed of, but there was nothing new there. There was no new information. There was no change in attitude. There was nothing. And after doing that, I would hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about the 180-degree turn that they had in here and this change of attitude. And nothing had changed in me. I mean, it's not that I didn't get some stuff off my chest that was good. And that's great because we are as sick as our secrets. And that was good. But everything that everybody else seemed to get from this thing, I missed it. When I was sober... probably 4.5 years, I finally was able to do a four-step the way it's outlined in the big book. And it was another great turning point in my recovery. And I did what the big book said. You make the three sections, relationships, fears, and sex. And I want to talk a little bit about resentments, fears, and sex. I want to talk a little bit about resentments because I think this is real important because a lot of people miss this. And the reason I want to share this is it did so much for me that if there's one person in this room that gets out of a four-step, out of the book, the way what I got out of it, then my coming down here is worthwhile. And when I did the four-step the way it's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I listed all the people, places, and institutions that I was burned up at, that had ever annoyed me, that I was angry at. And that was pretty easy because, you know, I got that on file. Right, I never forget. And I put down, matter of fact, the first part of the four steps kind of enjoyable. You know, you put down what they did to you, the cause. And then it asks you to put down what was threatened or affected. Self-esteem, ambitions, which I found out was another way of saying getting my own way. My pride, my emotional and material security, my relationships. And there's a list of things that lists in the book. And I put down everything that was a threat by each one of these instances. And then I went to the next two parts. And this is the gist. That's just the setup. And there's a lot of people I've met that's all they do is the first three columns, and there's actually five columns. And the next part is, it says, this was our course. And it says in the book that we have to see how the person who had harmed us was like us, perhaps spiritually sick. And somehow, I have to get honest enough with myself to put myself in their position and see how I could have done the same thing to someone else that they did to me. And that's real hard because I have a vested interest in a lot of my resentments. I like the fact that they did something to me, that they are so terrible and I'm so pure of heart. And there's a lot of dishonesty in my resentments, a lot of dishonesty. And somehow I have to take my defenses down enough and get honest enough with myself to put myself in their position and see, you know, if I was in their shoes, I would have probably done the same thing they did. Maybe I wouldn't have liked myself for doing it. And maybe they don't like themselves for doing it either, but I would have done the same thing. And in most cases, I found I would have been worse. I would have been worse. And whenever I'm able to do that, then I can take them off the hook and do the last part. It says, referring back to our list again, we ask ourselves these questions. And the greatest thing started to happen. I started to take the responsibility for every bad situation I'd ever been in my whole life. And it was the end of being a victim. See, prior to doing that step, the way it's outlined in the big book, I was still under the illusion that sometimes people did things to me. I was still a victim of feeling that you were responsible. If you hurt me, that you were responsible for the way I felt. And what I discovered is that I'm not a victim, I'm a volunteer. In every situation, I was the guy who did it. There's a line in the book that I love. It says, sometimes people hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made a decision based on self, on my own neediness, on my own emptiness, on my own need for attention, or more of something, or my own fear of you taking away something from me. And I made a decision based on self, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. And it goes on to say, our troubles we think are basically of our own making. And for the first time in my life, I could really see in black and white who the problem was. And there's a lot of hope in that. See, prior to my, at a gut level, acceptance that I'm the problem, prior to that, I lived in a world that my emotional well-being depended upon how other people acted. And the problem with that is I'm a good manipulator, and I can get everybody pretty much lined up, and some SOB would turn on me and ruin my whole day. And the great hope in Alcoholics Anonymous is that maybe with God's help, if I know that I'm the problem, and maybe with the rest of these steps, that I can change me so I can feel comfortable in this world. That if I can get out of the way, maybe God can work on me enough and change me enough that I don't have to be a victim of the bondage of self any longer. And I started not too long after that getting into the amends. And amends are very, very important. I sponsor a lot of guys, and I believe in 100% restitution. And that usually when they find out that, they quit you. And I think that there's a spiritual principle that what I do to you, one way or another, I'm going to get even with me. And that if I don't get even with you and make the amends, that I'm going to get even with me by sabotaging every good thing that life would ever bring in my path. And until I clean out the wreckage, until I clean up the wreckage of my past, I don't have a shot at getting what all you guys got. And when I got up to the eighth and ninth step, I spent a lot of time with my sponsor because I was petrified. I lived on the streets for a lot of years, and I hurt a lot of people. And I put down everybody I knew of, and I knew their names. I made a list of them, and there was just tons of people I robbed, and that I don't even know who they are. I don't know where they live. I have no idea. I don't have a clue. And my sponsor told me, he said, for some of those people, you may never be able to make direct amends. He said, the only way you're going to rub away the wreckage of that past and get even with inside yourself is to spend the rest of your life trying to help God's kids and rub that out. He said, that's your only shot. And I said, okay, I can do that. Matter of fact, I enjoy doing it. And he said that the other part is you have to stay open, that God will put some of those people in your path at the most unopportune and strangest places and strangest times. And you have to keep yourself in a state of constant readiness that when they show up, that you're ready to take care of business. And he says, you must keep your eyes and ears open for the opportunities that God will put in your path to rub away some of that wreckage. And it's kind of like the story of the old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy's sober 30 years. And he had some amends he never made, but he'd been waiting for 30 years to make some of them. And he's sitting in the park one day, and across the path on a park bench is this guy, big guy. He's a punk rocker, and he's got chains on, and he's got a cone of blue hair that comes out here. And he's got a cone of hot pink. pink hair that comes out here. He's got a cone of orange hair and a cone of green hair. And the old man's looking at him, and the punk rocker jumps up and runs over to him. He says, "Say, old man, what are you looking at? You got a problem with the way I look?" The old man says, "Oh, no, son, no, really. You see, I used to be bad to drink, and one time when I was really, really drunk, I made love to a parrot, and I was wondering if you might be my son." You never know. And I started to clean up the wreckage of my past, and I made all the direct amends I was capable of. And it opened some amazing doors inside of me. And I am convinced that if I hadn't started to do that, some of the things that had come into my life as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not be able to hold on to. Because I believe that I can never fool the God within me. And that if I'm not even in I.O., I know it. And if I'm not even and you give good stuff to me, I'm going to throw it away. Because I secretly, inside myself, know I don't deserve it. And I'm one who believes you could stand in front of the mirror for 100 years and do positive affirmations about how God forgives you. And if you're not even, you're just not even. And there's no positive thinking or positive affirmations that's going to get around that step. My sponsor used to have a saying I love. He says, if you want to feel like a lovable, acceptable person, you got to act like one. And for me, Alcoholics Anonymous has been a series of actions that has gradually and slowly changed me from the inside out. And I've gone through some things in sobriety. I've gone through some tough times. When I was here 3 years ago, I just went through a painful divorce. I used to talk about it a lot in meetings, and I don't talk about it too much anymore because I don't even think about it anymore. It's just that it was the toughest time in my whole life. My ex-wife had ended up having an affair with a guy sponsored during the marriage. He was my confidant and with my marriage problems, and it was horrible. It was horrible. One of the most painful things I'd ever gone through. And as a result of service and sticking real close to you people and real close to God and doing a lot of 12-step work, I survived it. And the most important thing that came out of that experience was a deep, deep knowledge that if I do what you do, that what I have here is a way to stay sober under all conditions. Under all conditions. See, and I don't think I really believed that. I don't think at a gut level, until I was right up against the wall and where I was thinking about suicide, I don't think I really knew that what you had here would work under all conditions. I think in the back of my mind was still the threadbare idea that if things got tough enough, If I hurt enough, maybe Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't be powerful enough to keep me sober. And I'm here to tell you that what we have here is a program that works under all conditions. About 9 years ago, my dad died, and it was a sad, but in a way wonderful experience because I'd made all my amends to him and we were real close when he died. And we were friends and he knew that I loved him. But about a year and a half after that, my mom came out to live with me and there's a guy that I got sober with named George. George was sober 14 years and he met my mom and they hit it off and they started bumming around together and they started living together in sin. And George brought a wonderful thing into my life. And he was very good for my family. And my mom and him and I would go to meetings together sometimes. And it was nice. My mom's not even an alcoholic. And it was a wonderful thing. And George was very dedicated to service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And George, after he retired, worked in a rehab, a Skid Row recovery house in Las Vegas, and he would spend all his time over there. And not too long ago, George developed cancer. And I used to go to meetings over at this treatment center, and some of us here used to, the guys that are with me used to go to those meetings, and George would show up there every night, and he would show up there sometimes in a lot of pain. And his hair had fallen out, and he was shriveling up, and he had that look that people get when they're dying of cancer, you know? And it was a sad thing. But you know something? It was also a very beautiful thing. George was one of my heroes. See, I watched George facing death, carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it, in no regard to how he looked after he... George had a beautiful head of silver hair. And I know, I know what happened when it fell out as a result of the chemo, how much he just sat and cried. And yet he showed up that night at a meeting, a newcomer's meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, with a hat on to carry the message of AA to these new people. And I saw him when he was in a lot of pain. And he wouldn't take the medication. He'd go to the meetings and he'd carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And George died 2.5 months ago. And I miss him. He was one of my heroes. And it's the people like George in Alcoholics Anonymous that make me feel so very, very lucky to have ever fallen in with a group of people like you. So very, very lucky. I am humbled sometimes by your selflessness. See, there are some expert lovers in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are some people who know how to love the unlovable, who know how to love the people who are so on the muscle and have the walls up so much. You know just how to do it in a way that guys like me can receive it. And that's one day, and my great, when I grow up, and I feel like I'm only 14 years sober, when I grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to be like people like that. I don't want to be one of those people who gets so well here that I don't need you and I don't need newcomers. I want to be one of those guys that's 40 years sober, that can barely walk, that's on crutches or in a wheelchair going to newcomers meetings. Those are my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are the people I look up to. And I believe in a principle that just to the extent that I show up and try to help God's kids, God takes real good care of me. Real good care of me. You know, I want for nothing in my life. I want for nothing. I materially, financially, I go anywhere I want. I do anything I want to do. I have financial freedom today as a result of you people and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous that you taught me how to practice in a job and to get out of the way and stop showing up there for me and start showing up there to be of service. And I can say from the bottom of my heart that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And that the high point in my life is not the times when I buy more property or buy a $50,000 car. The high points in my life are the times when I spend an hour or two with you. Or when I hear another fifth step. Or when a guy calls me up that I sponsor and he's in a lot of pain. Or when I go to a meeting and I see a guy that was a slipper for 14 years take a year cake. And I know the pain that he went through getting that ear cake. Those are the things that make this all worthwhile. And if you're new, I really hope that this weekend you'll hear something. That something here will touch you and give you enough hope to come back to more meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I believe in my heart, and I get up every morning and bet my life on the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I bet my life on it. And I am convinced that if I continue to live the way I'm living, that one day at a time, as long as I live by the principles of AA, that I will stay sober the rest of my life. And I believe that. I don't think I believed that 5 years ago, but I know that today. And you know, when I got here, I came off Skid Row. I had a lot of problems other than alcohol. I was facing 2 years in prison. I'd skipped out on some stuff from back east. I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have any clothes. I didn't have a car. I didn't have a job. I didn't have any job skills. I was over 1,500 miles away from anybody I knew. I was all alone. And after a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was new, a man came up to me, and I was talking to him, and I started to tell him my dilemma, all these other problems. And he listened to me, and he said, "Kid," he said, "none of that's any of your business." He said to me, he said, "you have one thing and one thing only to concern yourself with, and that's recovery from the dis-ease of alcoholism in the program and fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "I promise you that if you put as much time and energy into recovery from this disease in AA as you used to put in to trying to stay loaded and run the universe, that all these unresolved problems will take care of themselves." And I stand here 14 years later to tell you that I have only ever had one problem. And at times it seems like relationships. At times it seems like finances. At times it seems like the IRS. It seems like it's people not doing things my way, or they're hurting me, or they're out to get me. And I'm here to tell you from the bottom of my heart, I have one problem and one problem only. It's an inside spiritual malady called alcoholism. And that the promise I have is if I come here and clean away the wreckage of my past, trust God and try to help God's kids, that God will heal me from this debilitating and fatal spiritual malady. Now I'll tell you a story and I'm going to shut up. And this sums up the whole deal. I heard this story 13 years ago in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sure some of you have heard it. And it's a Sunday afternoon, and a guy has a day off, and he's sitting in his easy chair, and he's reading the newspaper. And he has a six-year-old daughter who he loves very much, but he doesn't want to, he just wants to read the paper and be left alone. And she's bugging him. She says, "Daddy, please play with me." He says, "Sweetheart, not now. I just want to read the paper." And she won't go away. "Daddy, please play with me." And he looks in the Sunday supplement, and there's an airlines ad in there, and it's a full-page map of the world. And he gets an idea, and he tears it out, and he tears it up into little pieces, and he grabs a roll of scotch tape, and he says, "Come here, sweetheart. Here's a puzzle. It's a map of the world. Take it in the other room, and if you can tape it together, bring it back, and I'll play with you for the rest of the day." And he figures he's off the hook. 5 minutes later, she brings it back, and it's taped together perfectly. And he can't believe it. He says, "My God, how did you do it?" And she says, "It was easy, Daddy. On the back was a picture of a man. And when I put the man together, the world just kind of fell into place." And if you're new, please come with us and do what we do and watch the most incredible miracle you'll ever see. Because as you change on the inside, you'll watch the face of the earth change. Thank you.